Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Mugambi Jue, also teaching at Stanford Law School. And let me tell you a little bit about what he's done besides the book that he's written on Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. His writing has been featured in Mother Jones, Slate, The New Republic, San Francisco Chronicle, Huffington Post, Salon, The Hill, Liberation, Le Monde, and academic journals. He's traveled widely within America and internationally. And he also had a great joke that I heard and was reported on when asked something about, you know, the Trump's sort of obsession with birthism. But I'll let him tell that joke. Thanks a lot.
My book aims to answer three fundamental questions. How did America go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump? Why is modern America so intensely polarized? And how is it explained by American exceptionalism? To answer these questions, we must look at the fabric of American society, at unique dimensions of American history, culture, politics, law, economic attitudes, religious beliefs, race relations, foreign policy, and beyond. That is what American exceptionalism means, that America is an exception. This may surprise some of you because of the notion that American exceptionalism means a faith in American superiority, that America is a special country chosen by God to be a beacon of light to the world. From this angle, American exceptionalism would mean exceptional as superior, phenomenal, or wonderful. But historically, American exceptionalism has primarily meant that America is an exception, objectively and descriptively, especially in comparison to other Western democracies. For example, America is the only Western democracy today to still have the death penalty and to lack a universal healthcare system. These are dimensions of American exceptionalism, but they're not inherently good or bad. It depends on what you think of the death penalty and universal healthcare. In my book, I argue that America's extraordinary polarization is a dimension of what American exceptionalism truly means because Americans are far more divided than other Westerners over a broad range of issues. This may surprise you as well because of the notion that today America and Europe are essentially alike because of the rise of Donald Trump's movement and far-right populist anti-immigrant nativist parties in Europe. And it's true that there are similarities on both sides of the Atlantic, but leaving aside immigration, there are a broad range of issues that are far more divisive in the United States than elsewhere in the Western world, namely European nations, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, such as whether people should have a basic right to health care, whether special interests should be allowed to spend unlimited money on political elections and on lobbying, whether climate change is a hoax, a myth, or a scientific reality, whether to teach creationism or the theory of evolution in public schools, whether women should have a right to abortion, whether contraception should be covered by people's health insurance, whether to teach abstinence-only sex education or comprehensive sex education, whether people should have an unbridled right to bear arms, whether to have the death penalty, whether to have mass incarceration on a scale not only unprecedented in American history, but virtually unprecedented in the history of humankind, and whether it is appropriate to reintroduce torture into Western civilization as a means of fighting terrorism. These types of issues, barring a few exceptions like abortion in Ireland and Poland, are either not controversial or much less controversial elsewhere in the modern Western world. How did America become so polarized? Well, in my book, I not only trace the path of American democracy, I also trace my own path in this country. Unlike Barack Obama, I was actually born in Kenya. My father is Kenyan, my mother is French from Brittany, the Celtic region of France, and after being born in Nairobi, I grew up in Paris in a multicultural environment, not very far from the Eiffel Tower, speaking French with my mom and English with my dad. But my roots are in America, in a sense, because my parents met in New York City when they were international students at Columbia. And I first set foot in this country when I was 8 years old, because my father had become a professor in California, and since then, I became fascinated with the United States. Going back to France, America was never far away from my mind. I spent a lot of time consuming American popular culture, from movies to music. I also spent time reading about American history, enjoying American literature, and I came back to America a few times on vacation as a teenager, and ultimately I decided to move to America for college, going from Paris, France, not to Paris, Texas, but to Houston, Texas, to attend Rice University. It's a fantastic institution. I learned a lot there, and also had a chance to broaden my horizons. I experienced Southern hospitality. People were warm and welcoming, but also saw things I'd never seen before in France, such as people who held fervent evangelical beliefs, who routinely said grace before meals, and middle-class people who had never left their country except perhaps to go to Cancun. Now, of course, the South is a land of diversity in every sense of the word. Yet, these types of beliefs and cultural traits are common in red states. But after living in the Bible Belt, I also spent a lot of time in New York, in New England, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Alabama, Georgia, the Bay Area, different parts of the United States. And what struck me was not only the huge differences between America as a whole and other Western nations, but a huge contrast within America. And this may sound obvious at first. Of course, there's a major regional divide in the United States that even preceded the Civil War between North and South. But what people tend to overlook is that the magnitude of this regional divide is extraordinary by international standards. If you leave Paris for rural regions of France, you might meet people who are more conservative. Same thing if you leave Amsterdam for rural regions of the Netherlands, you might meet people who are more conservative, and same thing for other European nations. But you won't meet people who widely think that universal health care is a tyranny of socialized medicine, that abortion is one of the greatest evils that the world has ever known, and that everyone should have a right to bear arms. But these types of beliefs are common in red states. Yet, looking at the data, we also see that there's not only a major regional divide, there's also a major divide at a partisan level nationwide, and that even blue state Republicans tend to take very hardline, peculiar positions on a broad range of issues. Case on point, Donald Trump. He's a New Yorker, and two of his main supporters during his very hardline presidential campaign, which was filled with conspiracy theories, were Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of liberal New York City, and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey. And that reflects a much broader phenomenon that long preceded the rise of Donald Trump, namely what political scientists call asymmetric polarization. That is, that based on empirical evidence, quantitatively and qualitatively, the Republican Party has moved far more to the right than the Democratic Party has moved to the left in recent decades. And that calls into question the notion of both sidesism, that today American liberals and conservatives are just as radical. And in my book, Exceptional America, I argue that today liberal Americans are closer to other Westerners than to American conservatives when it comes to many fundamental questions. That, for instance, the average French, British, or German person is likelier to agree with an American liberal than with an American conservative when it comes to questions like universal health care, gun control, or abortion. In fact, in the book, I cite fascinating data such as a poll from the 2012 U.S. presidential election, which found that an outstanding 90% of Europeans said they would have voted for Barack Obama over Donald Trump. That means that even European conservatives are far likelier to identify with the Democratic Party than with the Republican Party. Same thing. in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. A poll covering approximately three-quarters of the global population found overwhelming support for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. And in many ways, American conservatives have become outliers in the modern Western world. And that helps explain America's intense polarization and also how this is a major dimension of American exceptionalism. Now, again, some of you may say, wait, American exceptionalism, isn't that really the idea that America is inherently superior to other countries? Well, no, or not really, at least historically, that is not primarily what the concept has meant. Some people have traced the idea of American exceptionalism to Alexis de Tocqueville, or Tocqueville with an American accent, the Frenchman who visited the United States in the 1830s and wrote the masterpiece Democracy in America. And it's true that Tocqueville called America an exceptional country, and he praised America in many ways, such as for its trailblazing democratic institutions, for the spirit of innovation that he saw, for the sense of civic duty that he witnessed as well. But he could be critical of Americans in other ways, such as for their common support for slavery, mistreatment of Native Americans, and what he felt was a common pattern of materialism among some of his interlocutors. And as far as we know, Tocqueville never used the precise phrase American exceptionalism. Ironically, scholars have traced the popularization, if not the coinage of that phrase, to American communists. We used it in the early 20th century to argue that the so-called universal laws of Marxism would have to evolve differently in America because of its distinct set of social and economic conditions. In particular, Jay Lovestone, who was the president of the American Communist Party in the 1920s, had a theory that he called American exceptionalism. And he tried to distance himself from the Comintern, which was an arm of the Soviet state charged with the spread of communism abroad. And that did not sit well with Joseph Stalin. So when Lovestone was on a visit to Moscow, Stalin berated him, had him detained, and Lovestone barely escaped with his life. He later was expelled from the Communist Party. And after this epoch, the phrase American exceptionalism, referring to America being an exception, was primarily used by academics, historians, legal scholars, sociologists, and others who studied unique dimensions of American society, objective facets of this country. And it was not before the rise of the election of Barack Obama that the phrase American exceptionalism became widely used in the U.S. political debate. Now, again, some of you may say, wait, isn't the idea that America is inherently superior much older than that? What about, say, the city on the hill, John Winthrop? And it's true, ever since Europeans came to North America, there was a notion that this was a special country that they could mold into an ideal society and that Native Americans did not have a right to their land. Some founding fathers believed that Providence was on their side as it founded the United States. And in the 19th century, there was the emergence of another phrase called Manifest Destiny in 1845, which referred to the notion that the United States had a God-given right to expand westward and take over land from Mexico, Native American tribes, and to vanquish European nations aiming for a stake in the North American continent. But these ideas were not called, as far as we know, by the precise phrase American exceptionalism, which again was not widely used in the U.S. political debate before the Obama years. And the reason we know that is because data indicate that around the time Obama was elected, references to American exceptionalism skyrocketed in the U.S. media. And as explained in the book, that is because leaders of the Republican establishment started repeatedly accusing Obama of betraying American exceptionalism, equating the concept with the faith in American superiority that Obama did not have, and that Obama was turning his back upon the heritage of the founding fathers and aiming to transform America into Europe, or at best Canada, with his socialist and un-American agenda. And I provide quotations from leaders of the Republican establishment, such as John Boehner, Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush, accusing Obama of not believing in American exceptionalism. And as some figures accused Obama of not having American values, others went one step further in accusing him of not having an American identity. The allegations about Obama not believing in American exceptionalism were paralleled by the spread of conspiracy theories alleging that Obama is not really American because he has a forged U.S. birth certificate, that he was secretly born in Kenya. Now, on top of that, he's a covert Muslim with jihadi sympathies. Among the main proponents of these conspiracy theories were Donald Trump. And they seem to support a strategy that he later adopted when running for president, because, of course, he focused on targeting undocumented immigrants and also called for banning Muslims from entering America. And if you think about it, if the birther conspiracy theory were true, it would mean that Obama himself is an undocumented immigrant. Because if you have forged papers, you're not documented. So this would make Obama himself a part of the vilified group of undocumented immigrants, which were at the center of Donald Trump's campaign. And as there was this discussion about American exceptionalism and this other discussion about the intense polarization of American society, people did not connect the two together. But this is what I aim to do in my book by arguing that the extraordinary polarization of modern America is a dimension of what American exceptionalism truly means. In particular, I identify four factors as part of a nexus of polarization: profound anti-intellectualism, fervent Christian fundamentalism, a visceral suspicion of government, and racial resentment. Combined together, they contribute to forging a hardline anti-rational ideology that is very hostile to compromise. The first factor in this nexus of polarization is anti-intellectualism. That can range from simple indifference towards education or intellectual curiosity to a downright hostility against the learned. But more generally, it refers to a skepticism of knowledge and a notion that people really don't need to be too educated because common sense is just good enough to understand the world and to make money. And this type of mindset long preceded the rise of politicians like Donald Trump, Sarah Palin, and George W. Bush, who have an anti-intellectual style. In fact, like many other dimensions of America's polarization, they are traceable to admirable dimensions of American exceptionalism. In particular, the fact that America was the first Western democracy to emerge from the Enlightenment, that the American Revolution of 1776 preceded the French Revolution of 1789. And with the birth of American democracy came an egalitarian spirit. Now, of course, there were glaring contradictions ranging from the cruelties of African slavery to the persecution of Native Americans to the disenfranchisement of women in a firmly patriarchal society. But it was an egalitarian spirit nonetheless. And as the historian Richard Hofstadter explained, with this egalitarian spirit came a skepticism of education, and a notion that education was a badge of elitism, of the pseudo-aristocracy, and that people, again, really don't need to be too educated because common sense is just good enough, and that education is a symbol of anti-egalitarianism. But the paradox is that many of the founding fathers were intellectuals, highly learned men of the Enlightenment, well-cultured, well-read, some like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin even engaged in scientific experiments. Yet today, the citizens who most vehemently invoke the heritage of the founding fathers are often among the most anti-intellectual. And anti-intellectualism contributes to polarization not only by forging ignorance, but also by fostering receptiveness to propaganda, to conspiracy theories. If you think about claims, say, birtherism, death panels, climate change being a hoax, these types of ideas have much more influence in modern America than in other Western democracies. The second factor in this nexus of polarization is the weight of Christian fundamentalism in parts of American society. Christian fundamentalism goes beyond mere religious conservatism because millions of Christian conservatives throughout the world do not interpret the Bible literally. According to data, between a third and 40% of Americans are creationists who believe that human beings were created by God in their present form and that the theory of evolution is false. A similar proportion believe in apocalyptic biblical prophecies about the imminent second coming of Christ. These types of beliefs are very unusual in the modern Western world, except in the United States. And within the United States, they are primarily concentrated in conservative America. Yet, another substantial proportion of Americans leans towards liberal or moderate conceptions of Christianity. And that calls into question the notion that today America is primarily divided between believers and non-believers. Yes, the share of American atheists and agnostics has risen, so has the share of people who are not affiliated with the church. Yet, Americans without religious convictions remain a small proportion of the population. And today, as throughout history, the main divide has been among believers, especially between Christian fundamentalists who have resisted modernity and liberal or moderate Christians who have accepted it. And the weight of Christian fundamentalism in today's America is also a paradox, given that several leading founding fathers were skeptical of Christian dogma, including Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Paine. And among those who held Christian beliefs, they usually had more moderate views than the Christian fundamentalists of today, in the image of John Adams, who was a Unitarian. The roots of Christian fundamentalism's weight in American society are traceable to different dimensions of American exceptionalism, including the fact that Americans have not experienced as long a history of religious conflict and clerical domination as some Europeans did in pre-modern times. As a result, Americans have become less suspicious towards organized religion, less likely to see them as social institutions, and likelier to see them as mere means of worship or self-help. And hardline Christian beliefs were able to spread because of this disinclination to apply critical thinking to religion. And today, they don't not only shape hardline positions on theological questions or social policy matters like abortion, contraception, and gay rights, they also extend beyond religion by forging anti-rational, anti-intellectual, black and white, authoritarian mindsets. And these are also among the traits of Donald Trump. And they help explain why he was able to rally considerable support from Christian fundamentalists. After all, he does not appear particularly religious, even though he says that the Bible is his favorite book, alongside The Art of the Deal. And another reason why the religious right strongly supported Donald Trump's campaign was because, arguably, of similarities in their agendas, including repealing Obamacare. Which brings me to my next point. The third factor in this nexus of polarization is the visceral suspicion of government in parts of American society, especially what the Nobel Prize winning economist Joseph Stiglitz has called market fundamentalism, which is a notion that big government, taxes, and regulation are the causes of virtually all economic problems. This type of ideology is very peculiar within the standards of the modern Western world. And its weight in today's conservative America helps explain why Obama's relatively moderate healthcare reform proved extraordinarily divisive, and why the United States remains the only developed nation without a universal healthcare system. But there was an age when American Democrats and Republicans were likelier to agree on economic matters. In particular, after Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal economic model proved quite popular, it started being embraced by Republican leaders like Dwight Eisenhower. We didn't have a fundamental quarrel with the New Deal and post-New Deal era's more egalitarian socioeconomic contract and a notion that the government had a duty to provide for the people's basic well-being. In fact, under Eisenhower, the top income tax rate was approximately 90%. Yet, under Obama, it was 35% during his first term, and that rose to approximately 39% during his second term. However, Obama was accused of raising income taxes to all-time highs. And that is where this connects to another part of the nexus, anti-intellectualism, because this visceral suspicion of government is shaped in large part by propaganda and conspiracy theories and other fact-free assertions. And they also tie to another dimension of American exceptionalism, which is that in addition to being the Western nation with the most intense wealth inequality, it is also the only one, the one where moneyed interests have the greatest role over government. And moneyed interests play a role in promoting market fundamentalism as an ideology, and also in various areas, such as by funding pseudoscientific studies alleging that climate change is a myth. It also connects to another part of the nexus, Christian fundamentalism, because the people who happen to be market fundamentalists are often also Christian fundamentalists, because there are parallels between how to think about the economy and religion. In particular, they tend to have a focus on ideological purity. Last part of this nexus of polarization is racial resentment. And this is the one that's closest to what we see in Europe with the rise of far-right, anti-immigrant, nativist movements. But even in this area, America is unique because of another major dimension of American exceptionalism, which is that America has historically been the Western nation with by far the biggest proportion of racial and ethnic minorities. Today, they represent approximately 38% of the U.S. population. That's a much bigger share than Western European nations, and it's always been that way. Therefore, racial and ethnic divisions have played a bigger role in dividing American society historically. Think about the U.S. Civil War or the role of the Civil Rights Movement in dividing America. These were largely battles over the status and rights of African Americans. Now, sure, European nations also had slavery and colonization, but that was primarily in remote continents, in the Americas, Africa, Asia, and beyond. And there were few, if any, people of color in many European nations until the surge of immigration from former colonies in the post-World War II era. Therefore, European institutions like universal healthcare were forged in an age when the European population was quite homogeneous. That helps explain why Europeans and other Westerners are much likelier to support universal healthcare and see it as a program for them, something that fosters good government and something that's in the best interest of society as a whole.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Yet, in the United States, many of the people who vote against their self-economic interest, such as by opposing universal health care, think that it's not really good for them, that it's something primarily for racial and ethnic minorities, such as black people on welfare. And this is also where this connects to anti-intellectualism and the visceral suspicion of government, because racial and ethnic divisions have played a big role in rousing much of the country against the agenda of Barack Obama. And if you look at the declarations of certain influential figures like Rush Limbaugh, who alleged that Obamacare is reparations for slavery, you can see how these racial and ethnic divisions play a big role in persuading people to vote against their self-economic interests. So there you have it, the four factors of polarization. The nexus includes profound anti-intellectualism, fervent Christian fundamentalism, a visceral suspicion of government, and racial resentment. All these dimensions of American exceptionalism are themselves shaped by other dimensions of American exceptionalism, including positive ones, starting with the birth of the United States as the first democracy to emerge from the Enlightenment. They have old roots, even as they take on new forms. And much of this appears to be cyclical. They have combined to making America not only an externally divided country, but a land of fascinating contrasts. Consider how America calls itself the land of the free, and how millions of Americans are extraordinarily suspicious of the authority of government over their lives. Yet how the United States has mass incarceration on practically world record levels. Consider how America is the Western nation where creationism and skepticism of climatic science have by far the most weight. Yet how the United States was among the nations that played the biggest role in the development of modern science, and how Americans were among the first people on the moon. Consider how the United States today is the Western nation where clashes over women's rights and reproductive rights are the fiercest. That how American suffragists and feminists were among the pioneers internationally in the development of women's rights. And how American scientists invented the birth control pill that played a big role in the sexual revolution. Consider how America is the first and only so far Western nation to have ever elected a person of color as head of state. And how 8 years later, elected a man who claimed that his predecessor was not really American because he lacked a valid birth certificate. All of these striking, fascinating contradictions are also what makes America an exceptional country for better or worse. Thank you.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Mugambi Jue speaking about American exceptionalism and the rise of Trumpism. And it's time for questions and answers. Would anyone like to ask the first question? Good.
I wonder if some of the extreme polarization in America can be attributed to our two-party system. Like in France, the extremists can be shuffled off to the FN and don't have to be accommodated in the Conservative Party.
Yes, America's distinctive institutions play a role in the picture, including the fact that there's a two-party system, as you note. But there are periods where there was much less polarization historically. So, for example, after Franklin Roosevelt launched a New Deal, many of these big picture ideas came to be accepted by both Democrats and Republicans, and there was ultimately greater polarization in recent decades. But there was, of course, a two-party system in that epoch. So even though this is part of the picture, the main shift seems to be due to an ideological dimension.
Hi. What do you think needs to be done for the Conservative Party to be recentered more closer to the center, I guess, than further to the right, like it is right now?
My book aims really to understand how America evolved and how it got to where it is today. And parts of the solution perhaps may come from learning America's history, America's distinct social circumstances. And with that in mind, people might be able to foresee solutions. And also, perhaps they might be able to not demonize and dehumanize each other, which has become a recurrent facet of the problem. Now, in terms of how to lead to less polarization as a whole, that is an intractable question. And this is perhaps the object of my next book.
What do you think of the effect of primary elections, which are also part of the exceptional America? Very few other countries have primary elections that are as pervasive as they are in the United States, and they're often cited as a reason for the drift of the Republican Party to the right.
Yes, so primary systems can sometimes lead to perhaps more radical perspectives. But again, there were these types of institutional issues historically, and the main dimension seems to be an ideological shift. And also with regard to institutions, it's worth noting that America is essentially or the only, or virtually the only nation to have this type of institutional framework with an electoral college, which is rather anti-democratic. And also there are many other facets of American institutions that make it a very different country to govern. There's not only federalism and a lot of power that's decentralized at the state level, but within the federal government, there's a separation of powers, two chambers of Congress that can cancel each other out, the U.S. Supreme Court that can overturn decisions by the legislature and by the executive branch. And that's, as I said, makes America a very difficult country to govern. As a result, Obama was not able to implement many of the things that he attempted. And by the same token, Donald Trump is finding it difficult to implement his agenda.
I wanted to ask about our media and how it's different from Europe, too, because it appeared like during the French election recently, the Russian hacks really had very little effect on the election because they don't have Fox News as a propaganda machine, essentially. I was wondering if you could comment about that, because it does seem that our country is really different in terms of media as well.
Yes, France does not have the equivalent of Fox News, and nor do many other Western nations. The media in France also has an ethical obligation in its view to not spread hacked information about political candidates just before the votes. That was a part of the reason why the hacking of Emmanuel Macron's presidential campaign documents ultimately did not have a political role because the French media refused to disseminate this information under these circumstances. And also, there's a set of fairly complex laws which makes it actually illegal for politicians to comment on public affairs in the last few days before a vote. And by the same token, certain media outlets also cannot comment on the election within a certain time period. And that is meant to foster time for reflection and thoughtful debate before people get to vote.
Well, we're on the media. We had a professor in here maybe a year ago or so speaking about the influence of the media on the election and the divide of 50-50. And his thesis was that the lack of financial power of the three main CBS, NBC, and ABC over the last two decades, as they kept losing market share, that the income that they got from the election cycle was their biggest earner, and so they wanted those elections to be as close as possible so that their income would be the highest. Have you seen any influence? In your research, does that make any sense to you? Because I thought it was an interesting theory.
I don't discuss this specifically in my book, but I analyze how the deregulation of the media industry and the depolarization of the media itself reflects the surge of wealth inequality, especially leading many media organizations to focus on profit as opposed to informing the public, focus less on hard news and more on soft news about frivolous topics, and more sensationalized, non-analytical coverage of even serious topics. And we see that played a big role in the last election, where there was a negligible percentage of the news coverage that was very analytical and thoughtful. A lot of it was in the framework of a horse race, which candidate is saying what, where are they in the polls, and not really analyzing their policies in depth. Yeah.
Next question.
So you often hear about conservatism and liberalism over time in America being sort of a wave and people going toward the polls and then back toward the center. I'm wondering, A, if you agree with that, B, if so, like when you think that the last time it really started pulling apart from each other was? Like, what was the most recent cause of that?
Can you repeat the last part of the question? I couldn't hear you, please.
If you agree with like the initial premise that it's been sort of a series of waves to the polls and then back toward the center, what do you think the most recent time that we were close together and when we started kind of pulling apart again was?
Yes, there are historical cycles, periods of greater liberalism and periods of greater conservatism in American history. And the period when this started shifting started more or less in the 1980s. There were a number of different factors, the Reagan Revolution, the resurgence of the religious right as a political movement, et cetera. And also, as you note, here the question is not fundamentally conservatism or liberalism. It's the distinctive conception of these concepts, especially a peculiar form of conservatism in modern America that is very different from the perspective of many American conservatives of yesteryear, such as Dwight Eisenhower, who was much more moderate in how he approached many issues, and also who was much more amenable to factual information. And this is also relevant when we think about what happens elsewhere in the Western world. Angela Merkel is often considered a conservative, or at least a center-right politician in modern Europe, but her views are drastically more moderate than those of American conservatives. And by the same token, we see that, say, Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, the former British Prime Minister, who actually supported the legalization of same-sex marriage that was under a conservative government in the UK, or the former French President, Nicolas Sarkozy, tend to have a much more moderate conception of conservatism, and they usually support universal health care and accept climate science.
Do you feel, or do you have any thoughts around the role of legal education and the legal profession in terms of its adequately serving the American population on many of these issues? In other words, the educational function, the justice function, et cetera.
America produces a lot of lawyers, but many people have legal needs that are unmet. In addition to having mass incarceration, America is the Western nation where intense poverty is the worst in the Western world. And many of the underprivileged don't have access to lawyers. And many law schools put in a considerable effort in supporting students who want to go into public interest law, including Stanford Law School, where I teach. And there needs to be more of that so that the lawyers can fulfill their role of serving the least privileged members of society.
When you mentioned anti-intellectualism earlier as a platform of this authoritarian movement, to what degree do you see that as a strain of American exceptionalism particular to or conducive to this authoritarian movement, and how much do you see it as a problem for Americans generally?
Anti-intellectualism can make people receptive to authoritarianism, and certainly anti-intellectual propaganda or an anti-intellectual mindset played a big role in European history with the rise of Nazism, fascism, and communism. And with regard to this issue, of course, it's a difference of degree. So even in modern Europe, anti-intellectualism has influence, but it's not on the same magnitude as in the modern United States, and does seem to play a big role in the picture.
But we haven't yet gotten back to having a party called the Know Nothing Party, which was when the late 19th century or whatever was popular for a while, the Know Nothing Party in America.
Yes, and also with regard to this issue, it's striking that even as anti-intellectualism is very influential in parts of American society, America also has a vibrant intellectual life. It's produced outstanding writers from F. Scott Fitzgerald to Richard Wright, amazing musical composers from Aaron Copland to John Coltrane, the virtuoso jazzman, and so many great thinkers who have been very influential actually abroad. And this is a big part of the contradiction of American society.
Next question.
Would you comment a little bit about what's going on in Europe? These, you know, there's definitely a rise in racial resentment. There's Brexit. There's right-wing, you know, resurgent right-wing in France, Poland, Hungary. Is there a danger of the kind of values that are represented by the European Union in some facets being sort of dissembled or falling apart?
So the division of Europe today is largely traceable to what you mentioned. On one hand, there is the weight of nativism, resentment towards immigrants, towards Muslims and other minorities. And on the other hand, there is hostility towards the European Union. But the two are intertwined because the European Union is accused of opening up borders and enabling immigration, undermining national sovereignty. And both immigrants and the EU are blamed for the problems of European nations. There was a period when there was a tremendous room for concern, and perhaps it still is, about whether the European Union would be dismantled. The win of Emmanuel Macron and his unabashedly pro-European presidential campaign in France seems to perhaps make the picture more complex and even less predictable. But what's also striking is that after Donald Trump was elected, that evolution in American democracy alarmed mainstream European conservatives, who, as I mentioned before, strongly identify with the Democratic Party, at least much more so than with the Republican Party, and many, if not the vast majority of mainstream European conservatives, wanted Hillary Clinton to win. However, far-right European parties were ecstatic when Donald Trump was elected, and it's revealing that the Republican Party, which is technically a mainstream conservative party, has aligned itself with far-right European political parties.
was just curious. You kind of mentioned in the beginning that, you know, you've traveled around the country, you've lived a lot of places, and you have these four kind of qualities of American exceptionalism. If they're kind of concentrated amongst certain groups of people or kind of spread out widely, so anti-intellectualism, is it that even maybe progressives would have a kind of persuasion to be anti-intellectual and kind of askew talking about what university they went to or kind of wanting to be the average guy, and that's kind of an ideal that we hold up collectively even if someone is progressive? Or if it's kind of like these group of people have these things and these group of people have these things and this group happened to win this election and so that's why we are where we are, or if kind of these are underlying qualities of Americans in general that then have compounded with the way our system is set up and all these other things we've been talking about led to kind of this rise in conservative power in places of government. So it's a long question. I can repeat it if you want some clarification on it.
Anti-intellectualism is, as you know, a broader dimension of American society. It's a subculture that transcends the liberal-conservative divide. And also, sometimes wrongly equated with stupidity, a lack of intelligence, or lack of education. Rather, it's a peculiar conception of education that is also present among some people who are college graduates and even at great universities, and even people who are very capable in their fields and very intelligent, but they have this skepticism of education that does not have a narrow practical purpose and tend to emphasize common sense and not value intellectual curiosity. And today it is more acute in certain parts of the country, and it is more used or is more influential also in shaping hardline conceptions of conservatism. But there were periods of history, such as in the age of communism in Europe, where it also had a major influence on the extreme left.
Post-World War II conservative thinking, like you said, was more moderate with Eisenhower and so on. Don't you think that like William Buckley and some of the other leaders of early conservatism that were really pushed the intellectual part of it would find it very interesting that it has become anti-intellectual?
Yes, one can certainly be a conservative and be very rational, thoughtful, well-educated, and certainly, there are many conservatives today who are troubled by the evolution of the country as well.
Those last two questions approach what I was thinking. About in your own teaching of the law, are there aspects of that experience that led you to your interest in this broader question, or in this question on a broader level? And if so, how do you respond to it as a professional teacher?
When I finished law school, I became a public defender, that is, a human rights lawyer representing poor people in criminal court. And mass incarceration and the death penalty are not only areas where I've worked professionally, but also areas that I've spent a lot of time studying. And I use them as examples in my teaching because they play a big role in shaping American criminal law and American law more generally. But what's interesting is that, as I note in the book, one can judge a society by its prisons. That was the view of Albert Camus, or Camus with an American accent. That's because you can really tell how much a society values the least privileged members of society by its penal system. Because a society that does not, to borrow the words of Bryan Stevenson, the great American human rights lawyer, society does not get points by treating the rich well. It gets points by treating the least privileged members of society with a common framework of decency, dignity, and human rights.
On the mass incarceration issue, some people blame the Clinton administration for its decision of increasing the large number of incarceration for small-scale crimes. But other people point to something that's very American, which is to privatize the prisons, and that gives an incentive to the system to have more people in it. Obviously, you're deeply involved in the idea. obviously both of those things had an influence on it, but what do you think is so influential that maybe it should be changed?
So mass incarceration is a very complex phenomenon that's shaped by many different factors. The rise of private prisons is a part of the equation, but there are much more significant influences. And it's true that this is an issue on which American liberals are actually not as close to other Westerners because, as you mentioned, Bill Clinton strongly supported very hardline punishments such as the death penalty, harsh prison sentences, etc. And both Democrats and Republicans have played a role in mass incarceration. That being said, in recent years, there's been a shift towards relative bipartisan consensus on the need for reform. Now, a lot of scholars would say that that's not gone remotely far enough, but some movement in this direction, and campaigning for president, Hillary Clinton was firmly advocating an end to mass incarceration and a more humane penal system, but Donald Trump called for making the penal system even harsher, even though America has mass incarceration on a scale practically unprecedented in the history of humankind. And recently, Jeff Sessions, his attorney general, called for federal prosecutors to systematically seek the harshest sentences possible, which is very striking.
So income distribution in the United States has become more bimodal over the same time frame you were discussing primarily. To what extent do you think that increasing income gap is a product of the major driving forces you've been talking about? Or is it another contributing factor that might accelerate and add to those same negative outcomes, or none of the above?
So wealth inequality is partly a product of all of these different dimensions. Polarization that's fostered by the weight of anti-intellectualism, of Christian fundamentalism, visceral suspicion of government, racial resentment, and these factors lead a lot of people to vote against their self-economic interests. They also help explain why moneyed interests and tycoons have a huge influence over American government. But what's also interesting is that this is a historic reversal because there appears in American history there was actually more wealth equality here than in Western Europe, and also where there was more socioeconomic mobility in America than in Western European nations. And today, the opposite is often true.
Hi. It strikes me that, to me, one of the most compelling arguments for changing some of our policies in the U.S. are looking at where we fall on rankings compared to other Western countries, especially when it comes to women's rights or access to health care. But that in the context of national politics, I rarely see politicians sizing up the U.S. against these other countries. It just doesn't seem to come into the conversation at all. It seemed to me like this was because to say that we are inferior to a Nordic country, for example, would be controversial because isn't America so great? I'm wondering if you think that would ever become sort of more of a talking piece for politicians to compare us to other countries that do seem to be performing better than the U.S. on various measures, and if that could ever be effective.
So as of late, Bernie Sanders actually had a quite comparative style of rhetoric because he often mentioned that America is the only Western nation without universal health care. He cited Scandinavian countries as examples, and Hillary Clinton, I believe, did as well. But there are often references to other countries in the U.S. political debate, as you mentioned, which is the idea that America is inherently superior to the rest of the world. And there's striking data I cite in my book about how national chauvinism is much more common in the United States than in other Western nations, and how it is frequent for both Republicans and Democrats to say that America is a special country chosen by God to be a beacon of light to the world.
It's time for one more question. Anyone like a glass?
I couldn't help but thinking how America seems exceptionally bad when you are talking about all of the things that we're not doing. And so I just wondered what keeps you here, working here, when you, perhaps you could go back to a more enlightened country where people are more intellectual and all the other things that you describe.
He wasn't talking about San Francisco.
As I mentioned, I became fascinated with the United States when I first came here when I was 8 years old. I fell in love with this country. I've always been intrigued by it. I really appreciate many dimensions of American society, from literature to music and beyond. And I wouldn't say that America is not enlightened as a country categorically. It has been, in many ways, a trailblazer with the spread of human rights, science, and other hallmarks of development, not only in this country, but throughout the world. And as I said, it's a nation of contradictions.
That's a great place to end on that contradiction. Thank you very, very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 115th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you.